Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu can't catch a break. For a second time, the national elections didn't deliver him the results he wanted. Now, some Israeli politicians say enough is enough.
No, we're not going to go to a third election. It's the kind of thing that you can pull only once.
And the Saudis have sorted through the wreckage from the weekend. The government there says the weapons that attacked their oil facilities point to a clear culprit.
It showed the capability of the Iranian regime.
Also, the Trump administration has turned its back on climate change, but that doesn't mean America is out of the game.
We've come to the realization that if the federal government's not going to do it, it's going to fall to the local level, and somebody has to step up and be a leader.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We begin today's show looking at the attack that has put the world on edge. Saudi Arabia today presented preliminary findings from its investigation into the attack on its oil facilities.
The attack was launched from the north and was unquestionably sponsored by Iran.
That's Saudi Defense Ministry spokesman Colonel Turki Al-Malki saying Saturday's attack was, quote, unquestionably sponsored by Iran. He stood behind a podium and showed various bits and pieces of metal. It was debris from weapons, which the Saudi spokesman said had come from the attack and were Iranian-made. The claims have not been independently verified, but Colonel Malki said UN investigators have been invited to draw their own conclusions. Iran continues to deny any involvement. Malki also showed surveillance footage, which he said was of the attack on Saturday, showing Iranian-style UAVs. A UAV is an unmanned aerial vehicle. That's what most of us call a drone.
This UAV is Iranian, and all the components that we have recovered and we have analyzed through our expert, it shows the capability of the Iranian regime.
Colonel Malki, the Saudi spokesman, said the investigation had not yet determined where the attack came from. But he was clear about this. The attack could not have come from Yemen because the weapons involved did not have the capability to travel that far. This challenges the claim of responsibility from Iranian-backed rebels in Yemen. Malki also said there were three cruise missiles that fell short of their target. He said chips and GPS data on those weapons could help identify a precise point of origin. Once this is determined, Malki said those responsible would be held accountable.
It was an affront to international law, and those responsible should be held accountable for their actions.
The defense ministry spokesman could not say if that response would be a military one. A direct attack on Saudi Arabia from Iranian soil would be a clear act of war, a conflict that could potentially involve the United States. Today, President Trump announced via tweet that he was putting additional unspecified sanctions on Iran. This could further squeeze an already struggling economy. And now, with the threat of war hanging over the region, what options does Iran have? Mehsan Behravesh was an intelligence analyst and policy advisor for the Iranian government from 2008 to 2010. He joined us from Malmo, Sweden, where he's working on a PhD. In his opinion, targeting Saudi oil facilities this weekend was retaliation for a series of attacks in late August against Iranian allied forces. Israel claimed responsibility for one of those strikes.
So it wasn't an unprovoked aggression against Saudi Arabia committed by Iran, but it was basically a retaliatory measure against Saudis who have been supporting the U.S. maximum pressure against Iran and who are believed to have funded those Israeli strikes against Iranian-backed positions.
What's in it for Iran to raise the threat level?
Well, this whole issue, I think, needs to be viewed in the wider context of U.S. maximum pressure. Iran is very much under economic pressure these days. Like, by one estimate, they only managed to sell 100,000 barrels per day of oil in July, whereas before the U.S. sanctions, Iran was selling over 2.5 million barrels per day of oil. But more specifically, Iran is trying to kind of establish deterrence and sending a message of strength that such actions, either economic terrorism, what they call, or economic warfare, or military measures against its interests, has consequences.
Does this retaliation, if it is a retaliation, does it provide any chance for a resumption of a diplomatic conversation between the U.S. and Iran?
No, but the issue is that even before these attacks, the Iranian leadership was not very willing to let the diplomacy apparatus have bilateral negotiations with the United States, but because they fear that this kind of negotiation or this kind of diplomatic solution might give the impression that maximum pressure has worked and Iran has been brought to its knees. So they do not really want to give this impression of weakness.
Whether the backstory is all about, oh, this is retaliation, this isn't really an act of aggression, the fact is Saudi oil facilities were attacked, compromising oil supplies, and the U.S. is in a position that it has to respond in some way.
The U.S. is in a position to respond, but it doesn't really seem reasonable to retaliate against retaliation rather than stop the cause of retaliation in the first place. And I think the Iranian leadership is basically waiting for the 2020 elections for the results to come out, and then they will decide what to do. Trump number two, if he gets reelected, he will be much less restrained from taking a military action, because there's not going to be a third round of elections to which he would be looking forward.
So Iran is hoping to kind of wait this out, and they're hoping to deal with somebody different after the 2020 election. But I want to direct you back to Iran. I assume you've been in touch with friends and family back home. Are they fearful of a war, or is all this drama happening at a high level and not getting down to the street level?
People are obviously very worried about the breakout of war between Iran and the United States. But given the fact that most people view this whole predicament as caused by the United States, the tensions have caused, prompted some sort of rally around the flag effect, and kind of boosted the nationalist sentiments across the Iranian society. So while they are really suffering, I mean, they are feeling the pain of sanctions, when it comes to the Iranian public opinion or domestic politics, if an attack, a strike happens against Iran, most probably, the majority would be in favor of retaliating, striking back, and defending the Iranian territory.
Mehsan Behravesh is a former intelligence analyst and policy advisor for Iran. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
President Trump has a new national security advisor. Trump named Robert O'Brien to the position today after firing his predecessor, John Bolton, via Twitter last week. O'Brien is in some respects an unconventional choice for the job. He's currently the State Department's chief hostage negotiator. O'Brien also previously worked for Bolton when he was the UN ambassador under President George W. Bush. Joyce Karam, a journalist at The National and a professor at George Washington University, sat down for a one-on-one interview with O'Brien earlier this year.
Having interviewed both John Bolton and Robert O'Brien, the two men are very different. O'Brien, when you meet with him, he's very soft-spoken. He's actually very personable. He's very nice to his staff. So that was just on the personal level. The interview itself, his politics, his answers made me think of him more as a pragmatic thinker, as a centrist figure in U.S. policy. He's not a dove by any means, but he's less hawkish definitely than John Bolton or previously Mike Flynn in this position.
I know O'Brien has been very effective at negotiating the release of hostages, but he's been fairly outspoken about the Obama nuclear deal as being a huge mistake. He worked under Bolton when Bolton was ambassador to the United Nations under George W. Bush. Where ideology and where actual policies are concerned, how much daylight is there between Bolton and O'Brien?
I think there is daylight in two aspects. One, in policy, he's more of Republican establishment. I mean, this is a guy who sat on a committee under the Obama administration on trafficking and antiquities. So it's he's not that ideologically boxed. So that's on policy. As far as his position on the Iranian nuclear deal, you can say that's also the Republican establishment. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect that I saw and I heard is his management style. This is a guy that's a team player who is very cordial to his staff. He has an open door policy. Whereas, you know, other things you've heard about John Bolton is he's very combative. He's very confrontational. So management-wise, that could bring a different environment to the National Security Council.
How did O'Brien catch President Trump's attention?
Well, as you know, Carol, Trump has given the hostage issue huge importance, huge significance. So he wanted to be known as the president who has helped free a lot of hostages. That happened with North Korea, with, you know, in Yemen. He wants progress on this issue, and I think that helped. He's also a smooth talker, very much like Mike Pompeo. He's very polite. So I think that also resonates with Trump after, you know, having worked with John Bolton.
As we've been discussing, O'Brien has done a lot of work on getting American hostages released from various countries. He's worked to combat trafficking of cultural antiquities. But in terms of real kind of heavy duty national security experience, I mean, would you call him a lightweight?
I think he's more of a safe choice, and in a sense, he doesn't bring in a lot of national security or foreign policy experience. But also think about it. We are in the approaching the last year before the U.S. election. I don't think Mr. Trump wants any turbulent headlines when it comes to foreign policy, and we're seeing a rising influence for Mike Pompeo as steering U.S. foreign policy. So in that sense, we are already moving away from a National Security Council that sets U.S. foreign policy. We're talking now more about the State Department, the Pentagon to a lesser extent, and we'll have to wait to see who comes in as the Director of National Intelligence. So the whole equilibrium, the whole balance of making foreign policy in the administration is changing in the last year.
Joyce Karam writes for The National and teaches at George Washington University. She recently sat down for a one-on-one interview with Robert O'Brien, President Trump's new national security advisor. Thanks a lot, Joyce.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, the United Nations is tackling the climate crisis next week without American leadership. That is, without leadership from the Trump administration. President Trump plans to remove the U.S. from a global agreement to cut carbon emissions. But America's cities and states are sending a message to global leaders: we're still on board. You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Next week, world leaders are meeting in New York for the UN Climate Summit. Notably missing, American leadership. 5 years ago, it was a much different story.
Today, I am proud that we can announce a historic agreement.
Former President Barack Obama stood beside Chinese President Xi Jinping. Their joint announcement and pledges to cut greenhouse gas emissions paved the way for the Paris Climate Accord, an international agreement to tackle climate change.
I commend President Xi, his team, and the Chinese government for the commitment they are making.
This moment, after decades of failures, signaled that international action was finally going to happen. But earlier in his term, President Trump said the U.S. would not be part of that climate agreement. As part of our week of climate coverage, The World's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler looks into the impact of the U.S. withdrawal.
There are two ways to measure the impact of America's policy reversal: by looking at what's happening inside the U.S. and what's happening outside. Inside the U.S., one narrative on climate action post-Paris goes like this. When the federal government stepped back, state and local governments stepped up.
We've come to the realization that if the federal government's not going to do it, it's going to fall to the local level.
Adam Chapdelaine is the town manager of Arlington, Massachusetts.
Somebody has to step up and be a leader. We have to do everything we can to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions.
This town outside of Boston is among nearly 4,000 state and local governments and institutions that pledged to stick with the carbon-cutting goals written into the Paris Agreement.
We're looking at the front steps in the plaza in front of Town Hall.
Chapdelaine walked me to the front of Arlington's Town Hall. The building was lit up green after President Trump announced he'd take the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement.
It was important to make note that we were lighting up Town Hall green for that occasion.
The green glow was a visible sign of largely invisible environmental efforts here in Arlington. Chapdelaine points out a couple of examples, the energy-efficient bulbs and the streetlights in front of us.
So now our entire municipal streetlight fleet is LED.
And Chapdelaine's official town vehicle.
I think my radio is probably blasting, so...
An electric car plugged in behind Town Hall.
I plug in every day just to top off.
In addition, Arlington residents can opt in to 100% renewable energy. The town's designing its high school to go fossil-free, and the whole town hopes to be totally carbon neutral by 2050.
That's another sort of much more broad, sweeping effort that we're undertaking.
But these state and local actions have only partly counteracted sweeping federal changes. President Trump has slashed regulations on emissions from power plants, air conditioners and refrigerants, and oil and gas drilling nationwide. Today, he's working to revoke California's ability to set its own strict vehicle emission rules. So how does the emissions balance sheet tally up? Analyst Kate Larson says today, U.S. carbon emissions are a few percentage points higher than they would have been if Obama-era policies were in place. And a report from the Rhodium Group, the independent research firm where Larson works, found that gap will just grow.
Under the current set of Trump administration policies, the U.S. is on track to achieve only about 14 to 17% emission reductions in 2025.
That's only about half of what the U.S. promised in the climate accord.
A long way from the commitment that Obama reached in Paris.
So that's what's happening inside the U.S. But it's not the whole story. The atmosphere doesn't really care about U.S. emissions. It cares about global emissions. And a big unanswered question is whether other countries will see the U.S. doing less on climate change and do less themselves. Under President Obama, the U.S. put its full diplomatic muscle into getting countries signed on to the Paris Agreement. Here's former climate negotiator Elon Strait.
If you were head of state from India, from China, or from anywhere, and you were going to meet with the United States, you knew that you'd have to be prepared to speak about climate change and the Paris Agreement.
Now, countries are supposed to announce ambitious new carbon cuts as part of the Paris process. They have to in order to keep global warming below the goal of 2 degrees Celsius. But the question is, will they?
I completely believe that the missing ingredient this time around is the United States leadership driving climate as a head of state agenda.
The new carbon cutting pledges are due by 2020, so we'll soon start to see the full effect of this U.S. reversal. For The World, I'm Carolyn Buehler.
Vulgar, extremely offensive, distasteful. Just some of the complaints that were sent to Australia's advertising watchdog. So what was so heinous, so hard to accept? An ad campaign about periods that shows what looks like blood. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
Infinity is a unique design and technology that provides.
This is a typical MaxiPad commercial. A nice-looking lady with very white teeth is demonstrating how absorbent the pad is, and she takes a test tube of this blue liquid and pours it on the pad.
Test by pouring liquid on Infinity. The liquid is absorbed and pulled deep inside.
I don't even know what the liquid is, like Windex. Anyway, the liquid disappears.
That's the two layers of Infinity doing their job.
So if this is what you're used to, this next ad campaign is shocking.
Have you got a pet?
This ad for sanitary pads from the Australian company Libra shows someone pouring liquid onto a pad, but instead of that blue stuff, it's red, and it really looks like blood. Then the ad cuts to a scene of a woman standing in white panties with the bottom stained red, and then close-ups of women's faces, but they're not laughing or doing yoga. They're grimacing in pain. And at the end of the ad, it says, periods are normal. Showing them should be too. Okay, now let me read you some of the complaints Australia's advertising regulator got about this ad. Quote, this is distasteful and unnecessary. Quote, we had young children watching this. And my personal favorite, quote, way too descriptive for such a sacred process. It's vulgar. It's a little internal conflict going on there. In total, there were more than 600 complaints. Australia's advertising watchdog dismissed every single one of them. The ad is part of the hashtag Blood Normal campaign. It was launched in 2017 by the European brand Bodyform. Nadia Lascott is with the advertising company that dreamt up the campaign. She was interviewed on the Adweek podcast last year and described where the idea came from.
Bodyform Libresse commissioned some global research, and out of that research came some shocking facts, like 56% of girls would rather be bullied at school than talk to their parents about their periods.
She said the company decided that it would challenge the stigma and, of course, sell pads in the process. But Lescott said getting the ad on TV proved unbelievably difficult.
We had broadcasting authorities of all shapes and sizes that would go, we love what you're doing. This is absolutely unbelievable. But can you remove this scene, this scene, this scene, this scene, this scene, this scene, and this scene?
So far, the ad has only appeared in three countries, Italy, Argentina, and Australia. But Bodyform hopes recent media coverage of the outcry in Australia will open up brave new markets and perhaps pave the way for wider distribution of the company's next ad campaign called Viva La Vulva. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Indonesia's capital, Jakarta, is bursting at the seams.
Traffic hell. Clogged streets in every direction, exhaust fumes soaking into your clothes. Greater Jakarta has like 30 million people, more than Australia.
So the government hatched an idea, build a brand new green capital. That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. Israeli voters have spoken again. The results are coming in from Israel's second national vote in less than 6 months. And again, there appears to be a stalemate. Remember, Israel has a parliamentary system. There are a lot more parties and hurdles in forming a government. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called for the vote, hoping to get a clear mandate to form a coalition government. But Israel's longest-serving prime minister didn't get it. It's looking like a tie with Netanyahu's political rival, Benny Gantz, and his Blue and White Party. The official tally comes out tomorrow. The World's Matthew Bell is in Jerusalem. Matthew, does this deadlock point to a third election?
I should probably preface everything that I say, Carol, with a caveat that in Israeli politics, almost anything can happen. However, we could be in for a surprise, but the feeling here is that this is not going to go into a third election. This is something I asked Einat Wilf about. She's a former member of parliament with the Labour Party.
No, we're not going to go to a third election. It's the kind of thing that you can pull only once. Right now, people are generally very clear that they're not going to let it happen. The Israeli president, which has quite a lot of leeway, has made it clear that he will not let it happen.
So, Carol, another reason for Tuesday's vote, which was unprecedented in Israel's history, had to do with Netanyahu trying to secure a majority that would grant him specifically immunity from corruption charges that he's facing. In fact, this afternoon, Netanyahu canceled his planned visit to the UN General Assembly. And just a couple weeks from now, on October 2nd, Netanyahu has a pretrial hearing. He's facing at least two allegations of fraud and corruption.
So if Netanyahu didn't get the majority in parliament that he wanted, does that mean he lost?
In a way, yes, but he's still prime minister. And technically, he could be picked by the president to lead another government, though the feeling here is that that's pretty unlikely at this point. Still, the end of this long era of sort of King Bibi, that's his nickname, the kind of bulletproof Benjamin Netanyahu as a politician, does seem to have come to an end. Here's how Mitchell Barak put that to me. He's an Israeli pollster.
Either he's going to go out gracefully and figure out a way to do that to the best of saving the Likud party, or even his own legal issues will become part of that, or he's really going to be thrown out because he doesn't seem like he can form a government. He definitely didn't win. What's clear is Netanyahu is in the twilight of his career as prime minister.
So that brings us to Benny Gantz. He's the leader of the Blue and White Party. If he's now in the running to be prime minister, what should we know about him?
He only became a politician, announced his campaign in January of this year. He's a soldier turned politician. He was a former chief of staff for the Israel Defense Forces. He spent time in the West Bank. He's 59 years old. He's the son of Holocaust survivors. Gantz is described as a centrist, but his views on security are pretty hard line. He led the war against Hamas in Gaza in 2014 and even bragged about the body count in that conflict. On the world stage, Benny Gantz is a newcomer. A lot of his supporters, though, here in Israel will describe him as a straight-ahead guy, as somebody who, unlike Netanyahu, is not sort of stained by corruption allegations.
Benjamin Netanyahu, he's been in office through two terms of Barack Obama as president and for all of Donald Trump's tenure. If it's true that he's nearing the end of his political career, what does that mean for Israeli politics?
If it is true, it definitely would be the start of a new era. You've got young people here that don't remember, you know, another prime minister other than Benjamin Netanyahu. And this is not just in the terms of personalities, of political personalities. Anshul Pfeffer, who wrote a biography about Netanyahu, he says that Israel's other political parties would now have to define themselves by their policy positions and not just their opposition to a polarizing prime minister.
One thing the parties will have to do, I think, begin to talk about real issues. We really haven't had an election in Israel on issues for years now. I think for Israeli society, one would hope there'll be less toxic and racist and divisive kind of dialogue that we've been having. And Netanyahu has been the man pushing that kind of conversation and exploiting it for his political aims.
On that last point, Carol, that's something I heard a lot from voters in the lead up to this election. Even people who voted for Netanyahu told me that the divisiveness, this vitriol, this kind of all-out tribal warfare has just been too much for them. And they're sort of hoping that the election is over and that people will really tone it down and figure out a way forward.
All right, then. The World's Matthew Bell has been covering Israel's election, and he's in Jerusalem. Thanks, Matthew.
You're welcome.
Part of yesterday's Get Out the Vote effort in Israel included Israeli Jewish women who drove Bedouin Arab women to the polls. Read their story at theworld.org. In the palm of our hands, we have access to more information than volumes of encyclopedias. Remember those? But all of this instant access is useless if you can't understand it. That's the situation for a lot of Mayans from Guatemala who now live in Florida. That population is growing as migration from Central America continues. Reporter Madeline Fox from WLRN in Miami introduces us to a group of teenagers who are trying to bridge the language gap. They call themselves the Mayan Girls.
Last year, a group of high school students in Florida needed community service hours before graduation.
Hello, good afternoon. We are the Mayan Girls.
By the spring, they were on a public stage near their high school in West Palm Beach, speaking Kanhobal, a Mayan language. The event was a Shark Tank-style pitch session in front of a panel of judges.
Our project is about translating important information into a Maya language. Our budget is $15,000, and our main expenses will be going towards equipment, outreach.
The teenagers speaking, Lorena Felipe Sebastian and Daniela Domingo, saw a need to connect with Mayan language speakers in their community and go beyond one-on-one translating. The students, who are Guatemalan Americans themselves, work out of the Guatemalan Maya Center in South Florida. It helps connect newly arrived immigrants and low-income residents to social services. And the students can speak to the center's clients in a way even its own staff can't always do.
I have tons of information
but I can't get it to them because I personally don't speak a Mayan language.
Daniel Morgan is a social worker at the center. It's a pretty basic setup, a room with chairs where people wait for help. Morgan mostly helps people with citizenship applications, school registration, medical assistance.
If I run into somebody who barely any Spanish, like I really can't use my Spanish with her, I'll ask the clients in the waiting room, or I'll call up one of my trusted translators.
On a recent afternoon, Lorena Felipe Sebastian helped with translations at the center.
Sometimes when I see them, they seem frustrated that they don't understand it, but like when we're there, they feel more relieved that we're there to help them. They have a better understanding of what others are trying to tell them.
But Sebastian and the other students can't always be at the center during the day because of school. So they'll record information that might be useful for members of the Mayan community. Recently, they translated information on a flyer about domestic violence, how deadly it can be. Here's high schooler Ramona Francisco reading the flyer in Spanish.
Un promedio de más de tres mujeres y un hombre son asesinados.
Then the girls discuss the flyer, trying to find words in Conjobal for some of the trickier Spanish concepts. They're not professional translators. They're teenagers. And Google Translate doesn't work for Conjobal. After landing on a translation, they start recording. The recordings are perfect for the people this is for. Literacy rates are low in Guatemala, particularly in indigenous communities. Audio recordings and videos can reach a lot more people than a written flyer. Next, the students want to make more sophisticated videos with skits in Conjobal. That's also why they went to that pitch session to raise cash.
Yuval chandio shaya a tiempo. Thank you for your time.
They got the money, and getting video equipment is next on the list.
The camera, the microphone, the one that hangs on the computer.
Sebastian says she enjoys the translations and helping a community that can get overlooked. But she's not sure it'll be her career choice.
For me, I mean, I want to work with the center, but like later on in my future, I want to be a boss in construction and roofing.
The Mayan girls do want more students to join them and more languages. Beyond Conjobal, languages like Mam, Quiche, or Acateco. Families, the students say, need information in those languages too. For The World, Madeline Fox, Lake Worth Beach, Florida.
The Trump administration has dramatically cut the number of refugees allowed into the U.S., and the president is considering going further. This could impact groups like the Rohingya. They're a persecuted Muslim ethnic minority from Myanmar. Many fled to Bangladesh and Chicago. The World's Tanya Karas has this story, and she's with me in the studio. Hi, Tanya.
Hi, Carol.
Now, Tanya, I understand you want to introduce me to somebody.
Yeah, let me introduce you to Nasir Zakaria.
So help me God. Thank you. I'm so happy today. It's going to be a new life, new future. I never been in citizen all my life. So today is first day.
So what are we hearing there?
That's from his naturalization ceremony this summer. He actually grew up stateless as a Rohingya refugee. He's from Myanmar. He spent a lot of his life in Malaysia in exile. And then he finally became a citizen just this past summer.
And how did you meet him?
I met him through the Rohingya Culture Center in Chicago, which he actually founded in 2016. And that was a couple years after he was resettled to the United States as a refugee.
So you say he founded the Center for Rohingya. What goes on at the center?
The center is basically a community space for the growing Rohingya refugee population in Chicago. It's a place where they can come to learn English, they can get childcare for their children, and they also can take citizenship classes in preparation for their U.S. citizenship interviews.
That's interesting. And how did he decide to create the center?
So he had kind of this epiphany one day. He got a letter from the U.S. government and he realized that he couldn't read it. So he walked into a restaurant and he asked a random person to read it to him. And then he thought to himself, wouldn't it be great if Rohingya people like me just had one place where they can go and get
same
help
thing,
with
like
everything?
My people, they need help. So what we're trying to do, we discuss with friends.
And so he did some fundraising and he started this center.
That's amazing. The Rohingya minority in Myanmar or Burma is something we've been reporting a lot on this show. And I have to ask what his own experience was like there.
He lived in basically in constant fear of being captured by the Myanmar army. And that was what he says happened to him. He says that as a child, he was taken by the army and he says that he was forced into slave labor. And that was a reason why he left his entire family behind and fled to Malaysia. And that was where he spent a chunk of his life as a refugee until he was allowed to be resettled to the United States in 2013.
I want to get back to Nasir and how he prepared for his U.S. citizenship test. What did he do?
Well, it's thanks to Susan Chestnut. That was his teacher.
Your people, about the Rohingya people, and about how hard all of you are working to become citizens of the United
States. She developed a curriculum of a citizenship class for Rohingya refugees, and she teaches it at the Rohingya Cultural Center in Chicago, the center that Nasir founded. And what she told me was that she basically had to go to the very basics of what it means to be a citizen.
They don't have a concept of citizen because they are not citizens anywhere. So they have no idea what this means.
And it is a special class for a population that has never been literate, even in their own language. They don't know how to read and write.
You know, it was like how to hold the pencil, how to make a letter, how to form an English letter.
And she just kind of decided to do this on her own?
Yes, and Nasir asked her to do it. He went around and he found her. And, you know, they talk about all kinds of things. They talk about holidays.
We did Halloween. We did Thanksgiving.
Susan literally had to prepare people who have never had any vocabulary to describe what happened to them, even in their own language.
Yeah, genocide is when a large group of people is killed or gotten rid of just because of their religion, just because of their ethnicity. That's all. You're right. Say that again. Good. Ethnic cleansing. Yeah. And it's what's happening to the Rohingya people.
Susan brings up genocide in that class. Why is she bringing that up with the Rohingyas?
Well, that term, it comes up on the application for U.S. citizenship. It asks, the form asks whether you have experienced genocide. And so for this population, it's something that they have to be able to describe to a U.S. citizenship officer because in the Rohingya perspective, this is what they are currently experiencing at the hands of the Myanmar government.
Yeah, I mean, ethnic cleansing at the very least with hundreds of thousands of Rohingya being forced out in just the last few years. Most are in Bangladesh now. So what's next for Nasir now that he's a U.S. citizen?
Well, he told me he can finally start thinking about his children's future.
My children can go to school. I have future for my kids. So this is important for me.
The thing about being a refugee, what many of the Rohingya at the center described to me, is that they're only thinking day to day, hour to hour, week to week. When they come to the United States, they can see a little bit of a future on the horizon. But when they actually get that citizenship, that's when they really feel, okay, now I have a permanent place, I have a permanent home, I'm a citizen, and I can stay here forever. I can build my life.
The world's Tanya Karas. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Carol.
Learn more about Nasir's journey from stateless refugee to U.S. citizen at theworld.org. And there's one more note to this story. Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi could face prosecution for crimes against humanity. A new United Nations report says the Myanmar civilian leader has failed in her responsibility to prevent genocide. It's a dilemma facing megacities from Lagos to Cairo to Manila. For decades, human beings have left the countryside and moved into capital cities to find work. And now, the cities are jam-packed, polluted, and hitting their breaking points. On top of that, with rising sea levels, they may someday be swallowed by the sea. Well, Indonesia has a plan. It's going to move its megacity capital from Jakarta to an island paradise. What could go wrong? The World's Patrick Wynn reports.
A few years back in Jakarta, I took a walk on the beach. That's not just sand. The beach was covered in plastic. Pepsi bottles, noodle packets, sand just carpeted with junk. This junk gushes out of the city through rivers, and trash spills into the rivers because the city's garbage collection crews are overwhelmed. There's just too many people. It just piles up too fast. Okay, head deeper into the city and traffic hell. Clogged streets in every direction, exhaust fumes soaking into your clothes. Greater Jakarta has like 30 million people, more than Australia. It's a super cool city, but it's kind of bursting. It
gets polluted, floods, the sewers are maxed out. It can be a difficult place to get things done. So,
Indonesia's President Joko Widodo formally proposed a plan to move the country's capital from Jakarta to Kalimantan, though he left
Indonesia. Yep, the president says, we gotta move the capital, or at least the seat of government, to a greener place. Some place we can sustain for, he says, 50 to 100 years from now. A place called Kalimantan. If you've never heard of that, it's part of an island that maybe you have heard about. Borneo.
Borneo is the third largest island in the world, located in the center of the South China Sea.
Every day in the forest just seems magical.
That's an ad for a deluxe tour run by National Geographic. Borneo is a Nat Geo kind of place. Just the word Borneo makes people think of orangutans wandering through lush jungles. The government is running with that image, describing it as an island paradise where they can build a, quote, new forest capital that is 50% covered in trees, a city where, unlike Jakarta, it's safe to drink the tap water, and there's lots of renewable energy and clean streets. As the president says,
ini demi visi Indonesia maju.
Behold our vision of a progressive Indonesia. That sounds good, right? But what do people already living in that island paradise think about all this?
I'm thinking that is a good idea, but they also will bring many problems.
That's Ari Rompas, an activist from Kalimantan. All this green talk from the government is nice, he says. But what about the fact that this island is literally on fire?
The current situation has problems with forest fires.
Forest fires. Big ones. Raging so hard that when they're really bad, they cause Indonesia to churn out more carbon pollution than the entire United States. Farms start these fires when they burn away jungle to plant crops. Small farms and huge agricultural corporations alike. It happens every year. They are burning right now, making this sickly haze, this smoke that floats through the entire region. And it just shreds your lungs.
A lot of people in Kalimantan are getting health problems because of the haze. So it's a very terrible situation.
So terrible that Rompas and others on the island sued the government. A few months ago, the courts took their side, saying the government does need to do more to protect the environment and the people and the orangutans, whose jungle homes are going up in smoke. The point Rompas is trying to make is, hey, officials, your green utopian city sounds cool, but your track record here is not great. Now, the government is doing something. This week, they arrested nearly 200 people suspected of causing fires. As for building that forest capital, officials have named a site on the east part of the island, and for now, it's very pristine. But they want to move fast. Construction starts next year, or at least that's the plan. And in just 5 years, they want to start moving 1.5 million government workers there, creating the island's most populated city. For The World, Patrick Nguyen.
Cheaters never prosper, except in video gaming, apparently. Around a third of online gamers admit to cheating. Now, it is illegal to build and sell bits of code that give players an advantage, but hackers aren't put off by trademark laws. A teenage hacker tells the BBC's Joe Tidy how this all works.
I'm in a hotel room in The Hague playing a game, and I'm struggling with it.
We're the orange team. I've got three players from somewhere in the world.
The game is Rainbow Six Siege. At peak times, there are around 150,000 players online, and today it seems as though they're all out to get me. Lucas, not his real name, is 17. He's wearing a baseball cap and has a balaclava on for pictures. He doesn't call himself a hacker, but in the eyes of the law and the computer game companies trying to stop him, that's what he is.
Okay, Hyper-V is disabled, that's good.
Lucas is installing his cheat software. The code he's made alters the way the game plays, giving me extra abilities. He shared bank statements that show his business makes around $1,800 a week.
First, it was only a hobby. But then I realized that I could make a lot of money off it.
He has dozens of wannabe cheaters on a waiting list too. But keeping the active user count low is key to avoiding detection.
Can we see what your cheats can do?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, look at that. So already I can see much further. And when I shoot someone, it hurts them a lot more than if I didn't have the cheat, right?
Yes.
Yeah, you got him.
That is not fair, is it?
No, it really isn't. I know quite some customers that actually are like in the top ranks by using our product.
Some of the top-ranked global players on this game use your cheats.
Yes.
This is a serious concern for the gaming industry. Esports is growing at a fast pace, with tournaments now regularly making players millionaires. Professional game streamers like Amy, known online as Bamyleaf, says it's ruining the fun.
For them, it may be like, yay, I won the round. But everyone else, they didn't get a fair shot at that game at all. Like, just put the time in. It's so much more rewarding.
This is a completely different game now.
Yeah.
Ubisoft, the maker of this game, says it works hard to kick cheats out. I saw their software in action within minutes of playing.
Oh, look. Golem 3000 has been banned by BattleEye.
But Lucas's cheat is currently undetected.
Get them to the extraction point.
In fact, the teenager says he plans to expand into other games. Clearly, this underground business is even more thrilling than the games themselves.
Op 4 eliminated all friendlies.
The BBC's Joe Tidy in The Hague. And that's where we leave it today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.